Good afternoon. Thanks for coming out. This is going to be a good session. What I'm going to do is first tell you who I am. I'm Jim Lewis. I work at CSIS. I'm going to introduce our speaker. He'll speak, and then I'll introduce the panel. So let's do that. And we'll have questions both after the speaker, Ed Amoroso, and after the panel. Ed Amoroso is the Senior Vice President and Chief Security Officer for AT&T Services and has worked on AT&T's network security strategy and emerging cloud protection services, emerging in the cloud protection services. I got that wrong. Sorry. He's been at AT&T for 22 years, so you're a lifer, right? Yeah, he's good. Beginning with Bell Labs, where he worked on the Unix operating system and securing it, and I wanted to make that point because I'm going to come back to it. He's authored numerous research papers and 4 books, including Cybersecurity, which just came out about 2 years ago and was written for a mainstream audience. He's testified many times. I've seen him testify, and he's great. Unix is an interesting lead-in to this event. How many people in here ever worked on Unix? See, oh, gosh. Unix is a good place to start, right, because we're in the middle of another transition in how people use information technology. And if you remember Unix, you remember mainframes, right? And we moved from mainframes to the PC, and then we moved from the PC to the Internet. And now we're moving to an environment where people will connect using mobile devices. Most people actually connect now using mobile devices, and where they will rely on software, applications, data that's stored somewhere else, and they might not even know where it's stored. But this is what the market wants. People like being able to connect. It's good for business, right? So we're going to do this. But as we do this, as we move forward and take the advantages that come from the cloud and from mobility, there will be huge implications for security. And some people in the room I know have said to me at various points, we haven't even caught up with the last couple transitions in terms of security, and here we are going into another one. So we have a great set of speakers today to tell you about what the challenges will be. We're going to start with Dr. Amoroso.
Okay, thanks. Okay, great. Let's see. You could argue that computer security kind of started in the mid-70s. In fact, we have one of the pioneers here, Steve Lipner. He remembers a lot of the early stuff. And if you went back and looked in the Orange Book from the early 80s, you'd have a list of what we thought at the time were the basic tenets of computer security, right? We'd have authentication, identification, access control, audit, a few other things. And interestingly, at the time, we put a lot of emphasis on assurance, which we probably put way too little emphasis on now. The problem is that as we've moved to a new era, to this era where complex infrastructure requires protection, I don't think those basic tenets apply anymore. In fact, I think computer security in a small scale, you know, versus what you do in a large-scale infrastructure setting is about as different as you might find a bicycle from like a 747. Fundamentally different and requires different types of protections. So what I have here is a list of what I think are the new basic principles. This is rooted in a book that'll be coming out later on, probably not later in the year, but early next year, called Protecting National Infrastructure from Cyber Attack. But it's based on all the stuff we've been doing in AT&T, and I want to show you. But first I want to show you some of the older techniques. Now, this is an AT&T building right after the Pearl Harbor. So this was the protective approach that was recommended. Now, I'm told that the glass in front of this building was pre-shatterproof glass. So the idea was maybe somebody would lob something through and these big shards of glass would come through. But isn't that an amazing picture that in 1941, that was the response to a large disaster? And you guys see the analogy, obviously, in the way we protect networks. This is kind of the way we do it in all of our businesses, government agencies, right? We find the gateway, in this case, a building into, front entrance to a CO in San Francisco, and we try and build a big bunker around it. And you can see that the windows up on the top in that left building is where you would probably throw the grenade, because you can get it right through one of those top windows. And you can see all the holes. I love the guy standing right in the middle like a soccer goalie. I'm not sure what he's supposed to do, but bottom line is that, in the context of computer security for large-scale critical infrastructure, this doesn't work anymore. There's no perimeter. Take it from me. I've spent a career trying to maintain one at AT&T, and it's not a healthy approach. It's not the way we protect infrastructure. So this is the first thing I wanted to show you, kind of as an old thing. Now, this is a picture of an airplane that I take sometimes down to Texas. I know Don Herring here sometimes gets on that plane as well. And I want to show you, there's a bunch of signs. Like, if you look at that picture, it's a bad shot, so you can't really see what's there on the door. You're more interested in looking at that nice flying day and that pretty airplane. But here's all the stuff that's on that window. Let's start with one. There's a sign there that says restricted area right on the door. And then if you go to number two, it says emergency push to open. So the question is, if you want to go through there, you just wait for or create some emergency, you can go through there. Three is no smoking, so maybe that has something to do with policy or security, I don't know, but somebody decided to tell you that. Then over on the right, there's a little bit of training for you, telling you safety first. Five says proceed, six says stop. And then seven reminds you that it's some sort of a controlled access area. And then eight is my favorite, doors do not open. So that obviously brings us around to number two, push to open. I'm not sure what you really have there. That's what the sign said, you know, and I think that this is also pretty indicative of what we do in a computer security setting in 2009. We start by building a big bunch of sandbags in front of the front entrance. We call that a DMZ. We've got a firewall, intrusion detection system, intrusion prevention system, data leakage protection tool, antivirus, anti-spam, threat management, and on and on and on and on. And we just load up sandbag after sandbag. And then inside the building, behind the sandbags, we say, move over here, don't do this, do that, don't do this, do this, do this. You're not allowed, and nobody can really keep track. And some of them, like the no smoking, is like not even security relevant. Like, I mean, I guess it is, but like something blowing up, I guess, would be a problem. But, you know, we have URL filters, we block Facebook in the name of security when there's really no fundamental threat. Like, you might allow YouTube and Twitter, but you block Facebook, and you go, why? And you're not really sure. It's just a bunch of rules. And again, hate to say it, but this is exactly the kind of thing you don't need in critical infrastructure protection. We've got enough complexity. When you manage critical infrastructure, you know what you're dealing with? You're dealing with an environment where, A, you don't and shouldn't even bother trying to understand all the systems that are out there. You'll never get your arms around the complexity. That's for sure. Number two, when there are problems, you can't manual your way through it. Meaning, you know, when you're working on something small and there's a problem, you say, I give up, the tool doesn't work, let's just stay up all night and manually go through and make all the changes. Can't do that in complex infrastructure. You know what else you get in complex infrastructure? There's not that one guru that you can call. Like, you know, when you have a system and it's broken, you go, quick, get insert name of guru on the phone, get him or her in here, and then they come in and they can calmly proceed to fix the thing. You don't get that in complex infrastructure. So all the techniques that we use that we've become very comfortable with fundamentally do not work. Now, I think there are 10 that do work, and these are based on a lifetime of doing this. I've been doing this for 25 years. I grew up around computer security and computer science. My dad had a PhD in computer science in 1965. I think it was the second or third PhD in computer science. And I grew up with an ARPANET connection as I was a little kid. Like, I've been an internet user for 40-something years. So kind of grew up around this, and this kind of seeped in. And let me show you the first basic principle, deception. So you all know that guy, right? That is a scary-looking man, right? Even if you haven't done anything wrong, he makes you feel like you did. When we used to catch bad guys in a telephony context, you'd do it by having the FBI kind of glomp onto a wire between, like, Sammy the Bull and John Gotti, and then they would talk, and one of them would admit to a crime. The FBI would hear that and then go arrest the guy, and you'd be in good shape. When you've got triple-des encrypted VPNs, it doesn't work, right? You can't glomp onto that wire and catch Sammy the Bull that way. You know how you do it? You trick Sammy the Bull into thinking he's talking to John Gotti, right? And that's how we catch predators with deception. Amazingly, in computer security today, this is so underutilized, it's not funny. And there's something very fundamental about deception. If you in a very non-stealth, open manner, argue that you're going to be dropping intentional vulnerabilities around infrastructure? Let's say the power grid, you know, the purveyors of our energy system say, you know what, in addition to upgrading our energy infrastructure, we're going to deliberately put misplaced, poorly administered, vulnerability-ridden servers across our infrastructure. Put yourself in the position of an adversary. How would you feel about that? You'd be like, suddenly every vulnerability you find in that infrastructure has associated with some degree of uncertainty because you don't know whether it's real or was actually placed there. It's a deep concept. It's something we use at AT&T. And I think that computer security needs to grow up, and we need to recognize that deception, I mean, in a warfare setting, we do it all the time, right? But in computer science, we have some aversion to the use of deception. This is one of the basic principles that I find is absolutely essential. Now, second one is separation. Separation is very different from putting a bunch of sandbags in front of your enterprise. We recently looked at a network design associated with a government entity, and place is kind of a mess. They've had a lot of data leakage. It's sort of quasi-associated with a university, so they have this feel that you have to have everything wide open, but they also have kind of semi-classified-looking stuff, and they've had all these leakages, and not sure what to do. Our suggestion was pull those assets and separate them. Put them in the cloud, for example. Like, build a fortress off in the cloud, separate it from your perimeter, and protect that thing. Put those eggs in a basket, protect the basket, and assume that your perimeter is whatever it is. Then suddenly, hiding something in a leaky, messy perimeter changes fundamentally. Now, this picture, unfortunately, is of the Titanic. So maybe it's not such a good metaphor for what we're recommending. I mean, when it was drawn, the idea of airtight didn't seem to play out in practice. But you get the idea. The principle of separation involves something that Steve Lipner remembers well from the Orange Book days, minimizing a trusted computing base around an asset and then protecting it properly. When you try to grow that trusted base, it doesn't work. We learned that 25 years ago. And what is every enterprise, what's every government agency? It's this trusted base stretched almost to the point where the bubble is going to burst if it hasn't burst already. We know that's not right, and we've got to get back to something different. I think cloud is an important element of that. So second one, after deception, is separation. Again, remember, go back and look at the Orange Book. What do we say? Authentication, identification, access control, audit. These are the tenets. I'm suggesting that these are the new tenets. Here's a third one. Diversity. Beautiful picture of this rainforest in Puerto Rico. The reason that rainforest lives as an ecosystem from season to season to season is because there is no one disease that will knock that rainforest out. Unfortunately, we've got a situation where there is a single architecture from a single vendor that dominates the way we do computing on the desktop. Now, that's changing a little bit. And I give that vendor, that manufacturer, a lot of credit. They have tried big time in the last 5 to 10 years to fix security. I give them a big thumbs up. That said, we've got a situation where everybody in here, at home and at work, you're using a single architecture, and that architecture requires that we patch it every month. Like, is there another technology on the planet where it would be considered acceptable to have a product that's knowingly broken and that every month we fix it, you know, using patches? Like, would we be comfortable if our cars worked that way? Like, my wife drives Volvos, and when she has a problem, she drives it to the dealer, and they all have to stop work, and they put, like, you know, these headphones on, and they listen. Somebody's got, like, a stethoscope to hear this little knock in the car. Like, that's how attentive they are to a little problem. What's the version of that in software? There is none. In software, the presumption is that stuff is just broken, and we can't fix it and deal with it, right? Blue screen? Hey, welcome to computing. Computer filled with a bunch of crap? Hey, you know, that's what you get for connecting to the internet, right? I mean, you have this monotonically decreasing integrity function. You go to Best Buy, they give you a computer, they put security software on, and it kind of muddles through for a year. Then you get phishing messages saying, you know, give me a credit card. You got to upgrade this, upgrade that. You didn't even buy half that stuff. So you're afraid to upgrade, so you don't. Security software expires. Then you have this decreasing integrity function. You start, the machine's going all the time, right? You have bots on your machine. And then it gets intolerable, and you do one of two things. You either learn to re-image it, or you rationalize and you go buy a new computer. That's what we all do. And that's why diversity is absolutely essential. If we've got things that are software-based that we have already accepted are broken, then we have to demand that across the enterprise there's diversity, because if you don't, you know, the cascading problem becomes very easy. I mean, my team and I, we all come from hacking backgrounds, and the first thing we do when we try to build large-scale attacks is guesstimate what you've got and hope that it cascades from one place to another. And, you know, it's a Mac is like a bad word in hacking because it's different. And people say, well, you know, the reason you don't see attacks on, you know, on Apple is because there aren't as many users. Well, I have two comments. One is, I don't think that's right. I think Unix is an operating system that's been through the ringer, right? Who was president when Unix was developed? It was Lyndon Johnson. So it's been around for a while. But that said, you know, hackers found a heap overflow in the iPhone, which kind of freaked out a lot of people in the computer science community, because it suggested that maybe Apple will have some of the same problems that Microsoft had. We'll see. Diversity is the way to deal with this in a large scale. Now, this is a cool. I like this picture. If you've been over to Air and Space or you've seen something, isn't it amazing that Apollo astronauts got a lunar module that had basically aluminum foil, you know, around it? Wouldn't you be afraid that you'd like kick it, or like your elbow would go through, or something would go through? I always meant to ask, you know, if I ever met one of those guys, you got a lot of confidence in that one layer. I think too much of computer security is that kind of thing, where we have this very thin veiled layer, like denial of service attack. Sometimes the way you stop a denial of service attack is you say, I've got a CDN, scatters my resources around, and hackers would have to work really hard to stop me. So you got one layer of kind of defense, and it amazes me when people are under attack and they sleep well at night, like thinking that that one layer is going to work. I had a situation where we were under pretty significant attack about a year ago. And for 21 days, I couldn't sleep because I was reliant on one control. It's the only way I could have stopped the denial of service attack at the time. We were doing, you know, route management in the backbone, and we were diverting traffic through scrubbers. If that didn't work, we were toast, and it felt very, very uncomfortable. So I think that as you're protecting infrastructure, there is a requirement that some demonstrable evidence be put in place that assets and services that are essential be protected by at least two different layers of defense. That should be something that's embedded into the audit process, and it's not today. Again, not part of sort of computer security to date. This is a young tsunami survivor. He's Indian Islands. You guys all hear about how occasionally these islands have these imminent problems, and some of the elders kind of smell the problem or sense the problem or have some instinct, and everybody runs up to higher ground and they all live. Or the animals. Somehow the animals know that a tsunami's coming. How about the guy in California who does the CAT index? He's like kind of a crazy dude. I mean, not acronym CAT, but real cats. He keeps track of lost cats, and he correlates that with earthquakes. And it's like a correlation there. Like, all the cats go nuts before an earthquake. And, you know, we would all look at that. I mean, I'm a scientist. I teach in an engineering department. It's my requirement that I frown at that and say, how stupid that is. But after I say that, I go, you know, maybe there's something there. What's happening is some deep level of correlation. And it's hard to put your finger on it. But when you work in a fusion center, and I've run and built and operated many of them, including the Y2K center that we did, the correlation center for the White House, the only way to deal with data and to make decisions, actionable decisions, is by developing a capability, a correlation capability, that's not just computer science. It's got to be something more. And that's why correlation centers, I think, in 2010, still require human beings exercising some degree of judgment. So proper correlation is both collecting data, having good algorithms, but also having experienced individuals who, in some cases, just sense that something's going wrong. I know in my own experience, I can't tell you how many times we've been on big technical bridges at 3 in the morning, bunch of stuff is broken, we stop for a minute, and I just sit there and say, I just have a feeling that, and then insert something. And we'll say, you know what? I'm not really sure why, but I have a feeling that it's this server, this network, or whatever. Guys, we got to go flip that and see what happens. And in many cases, it works. And again, that little child is the best I could come up with. I mean, it's such a non-technical concept, but in protecting infrastructure, it's essential. So if you don't have that capability, if you don't have the staff that have been at this for a long time, you better go find yourself a partner that does. Collecting and using data intelligently, you know this one, is the extraterrestrial thing. I don't know how many geeks out there do this. I think this is the coolest thing on the planet, right? I mean, this is a bunch of people collecting, listening for extraterrestrial activity. And, you know, some of the coolest peer-to-peer applications, I think, just copy off the way this thing has worked. I mean, let's face it, data collection right now has gotten a bad kind of, it's gotten a black eye because one of the main topics is privacy, right? The privacy community will go, well, you collect data, you know, that's not good. And it always confuses a service provider because the way we've been doing toll fraud for the last 25 years is that we profile your usage in a telephony context and then call you up and say, hey, we noticed you're calling Albonia all day. Did you mean to do that? And you go, no. And we say, well, you know, you're PBX. And you usually thank us and run off. Nobody ever once in the history of toll fraud protection said, you mean you're looking at our telephony usage? And it's like, well, yeah, like your credit card company does the same thing, right? They're looking at patterns of usage. I recently gave a keynote and spent a day with the Society for Privacy Professionals. And I went to the booths and talked to the group, and I'm thinking, and again, you know, folks like Steve have been around this for a while. In the early days of computer security, we didn't really know what our issues were. I think the privacy community still has to figure out what their issues are. Like, most of the booths at a privacy conference are companies trying to sell identity management stuff. And you go and you ask them, you say, is that the privacy issue? And the privacy folks say, no way, but the vendors say yes. Like, because I guess there's a financial model there. So it's like, that's not the main issue, but it's certainly there. That's a very, very big sort of consideration. The second piece of it is advertising, right? The idea that hidden aggregators are pulling data as you're off doing what you do. You know, you visit CNN, and boom, all this hidden aggregation is going on, and maybe you're looking at a story about elephants on CNN, and all of a sudden the ads are like bannered elephants marching up and down the screen. You know, you ask the community, is that the issue? And they'll go, well, yes and no, and then it might be around, like, you know, privacy of your communication. And you say, well, what are the issues? Like, law enforcement clearly has to have the ability to do what they want to do. And then people will say, yeah, that's true. And go, well, that's what we have now. So it's like, I think the privacy community needs to figure out and sort of mature into its set of issues. And service providers, you know, will act accordingly. Look, we're part of society. We provide services that we hope you like and use. We go out of business if you don't. And we're Americans just like the rest of you. I mean, we want our privacy protected as well. So the key word up there is intelligently. We need to come to some set of sort of best practices around the types of data you collect, how it's used, and how it's made actionable. Again, basic tenet of infrastructure security. Now, you guys remember this picture? Those two jets apparently are 2.5 miles away, but boy, they sure look like they're touching each other. The idea here around situational awareness should be obvious. When you're running a center, when you're managing critical infrastructure, the idea of having information about your present state is absolutely essential. Think how silly that is in a small context, right? If you're running a home network, you know, with a couple of PCs, what does situational awareness mean? It doesn't mean anything. And if you go pick up the 50 or 100 computer security books that were published just in the last week, you know, there wouldn't be any mention of situational awareness, maybe a couple of sentences in the context of incident response. But it is absolutely essential in the context of critical infrastructure protection. You need metrics, you need tools, and you got to be careful because the tendency is to want to build a bunch of screens. Like if you work in some agency, you want to collect data, dim the lights, put a bunch of screens up, and you know, make swirlies in different colors that help you generate revenue, right, and funding, and press the funding sources. That's not critical infrastructure protection. Again, getting funding is good, and if you're going to do it, call it marketing, call it what it is. But situational awareness is all about accurate metrics that help you determine actionable items. So this is another key one. This is a funny one. It's a picture of a lady at circa 1935. You know what that is? She's pulling a fire alarm, and as she pulls the fire alarm, a clamp comes down on her wrist and makes her stay there until the fire department shows up to let her out. You know, it's to stop false alarms. Look how happy she is, right? That is the ultimate in dependable incident response, right? Like, I know they're going to be here, so I don't mind the flames licking at my heels here. I'm going to pull this thing and stand here until the incident response team comes. I think the computer security version of this should be sort of obvious. We don't generally see dependable, predictable, repeatable incident response. We see something else. I'm not always sure what it is, but there's an old thing we have in AT&T. Our joke is a lot of our customers use incident response as the 51st job, which means you have 50 jobs already, your tongue's dragging on the ground, you're missing all the Little League games, you're working weekends, and then somebody comes up to you and goes, hey, you know, guess what? You're going to be on the incident response team. They give you another phone or something, and that means when there's a problem, you're the subject matter expert on an incident response team. What have I just incented you to do? I've incented you to pray each day that there are no incidents, because if there's no incidents, there's no incident response, and you only have 50 jobs. The problem is incident response has to be the inverse of that. It has to be unbelievably proactive. Like a term that we use in computer security that's so wrong is false positive. That's a crazy term. Like, would you want your doctor to use that? Doctor goes to the nurse at the end of the day. So, bad day, huh? And she goes, yeah, like nobody died. Like everybody came in and it was like a bunch of false positives. We got to change. You know what? Well, let's not let people in here unless they're really sick, because they're wasting our time, you know, with all these well people coming in, where you get the sort of obvious craziness in that concept. False positive is a bad approach when you're dealing with critical infrastructure. So with my team, I have a dedicated incident response team that's incented to do more incident response, meaning we turn up incident response bridges when a UDP port is misbehaving on the backbone. How'd you like to be woken up at 2 o'clock, jump to a bridge, and somebody says, UDP port 1712 is 2 standard deviations from the norm, and as you're sort of catching your breath, you say, are there any customers complaining? No. Is our boss complaining? No. Is this realizing itself on any network? No. Is this visible to anyone at all? Well, just the graph. How would you feel about being on that kind of an incident response bridge? You'd love it if you were incented to be on that bridge, if you're incented to do it, if it's part of your job, if it's normal, if the feeling is, I have to do thousands of these to catch the one that's going to be a real problem. That's incident response. And that, you know, that's the only time I would ever, you know, put my hand in that box. You know, if I knew that the response team is not a 51st job kind of thing, but rather is incented and measured and rewarded for going off and doing response very quickly, even to something like that. So we'll say goodbye to our happy lady there. Discretion. Now, this one I always get killed for. By the way, that's picture of Three Mile Island. I went to college at Dickinson College as an undergraduate, studied physics there. And I started in 79. So that summer, I went and toured that right after the big meltdown. And it's cool. I was a physics major, so we all got to tour the plant. And I have, like, this little pin from 1980 that says, friend of Three Mile Island. I guess I'm a friend of Three Mile Island. Didn't know it at the time. But those are the reactors that blew up. And the point is, one of the things that they told us on the tour
when I was an undergraduate was. Somebody said, hey, where are we located here? And she went, oh, my gosh. We would never, ever, ever, ever give out the coordinates of, you know, the of the reactor, because an enemy would just love to do it. It's kind of funny that, you know, half the tools on the internet can give you a picture and a coordinate of this thing. Now, look, discretion is something that we don't tend to talk about in computer security. In fact, most security experts love to say security through obscurity, comma, ha ha ha, boy, that doesn't work. You know, that's not right. I mean, yeah, in crypto algorithms, we shouldn't rely on the obscurity of an algorithm to protect the cryptography. I totally get that. But you know what? A lot of you work in government. You know how important it is to exercise human discretion around information. Why don't we ever say that? Like, if you work in a classified setting, it's your instinct to know that you compartmentalize information and you compartmentalize infrastructure. And that's how you do it. Then let's say you worked at NSA doing that, and you go to work at some bank, and day one, they snap you into an enterprise network where you can see everything. There's no compartments in a bank. You just see everything. It's a flat network, and they'd say, well, we got all these sandbags in front of the windows, and we got all these rules like at the airport, and that's how we do security. Wrong. That's not the way to do it. We need to, you know, amazingly, learn something from the intelligence community. And employing discretion, you know, intelligence community would be called clearances, classification, security policy, multi-level security. But in industry, it's time now that we recognize that all this these bad words we say around security through obscurity are themselves wrong. Here's my last one. Look at that guy in the middle. Isn't that cool? Like, there's a Wisconsin fan at a Navy football game. He's got the red sweatshirt in the middle. I think that's such a cool picture. Like, he stands out, right? I'll tell you what, commonality and diversity sure sound like opposing terms, don't they? What I mean when I say commonality here is when you set up configurations, like, for example, in the wireless industry, we have certain configurations that we put in place. When you have Wild West in terms of configuration, every city with something different, makes it very difficult to find Trojan horses, malicious insertions, malicious changes, anything that would be put there intentionally to degrade the operation of the system. So we use commonality in setup and provisioning and architecture and operation to try to expose things that would look like that Wisconsin Badger fan standing there in the middle. So the basic concept here is that I really think that in 2010, it's time to go back and rethink. Here's an example of what I'll give you one example, and then I'll stop and take some questions. You know, we make all our folks go do CISSP training. Have you ever gone back and looked at that curriculum? I hate to say it, but it is so 20 years ago. Right? As far as I'm concerned, the CISSP exam trains people to have a level of understanding around computer security commensurate with maybe a 1990 level of understanding. I think it should be this stuff. I think that we should be training people to understand how you introduce diversity into an architecture or effectively use honeypots to catch bad guys or to separate assets in an architecture and create a small trusted computing base around them, or how to provide some degree of commonality in setup across massive infrastructure. It's hard now to point to anything that's small because everything's so connected that you really can't say I'm a LAN administrator without also recognizing that that LAN probably includes wireless access, 3G access, and the like. I mean, look, you have you may be working some agency and you hide everybody behind some perimeter, and you make the laptops and so on go through a gateway to the internet. Well, what if somebody has a 3G card that they pop into their machine and just go connect directly? Do you say, no 3G cards allowed in the building? Well, you could do that, but then you say, what about my iPhone or my BlackBerry? I mean, I use that to go directly. Now, do you want to put policy on the black? Get point, like perimeter. This doesn't work anymore. It's not a model that we should be building toward. It's something that requires a dramatic rethinking, and you can't do that overnight, right? You can't go shut down your gateways, but it is a direction that I think we need to be working. So with that, I'm going to stop and see if you guys have some questions. Before we get to our fine panel here, I'm sure they'll all have some things to say about their topic and maybe comment on the large-scale issue as well. Question? Alan, right? Alan Pollard, right? Somebody who knows quite a bit, right?
So, my thinking is the commonality is actually more important. It turns out that if you have a common set of systems under common control, you actually can make them look diverse to the enemy.
Yeah.
You don't have to let people buy. You don't have to let people buy anything they damn well please, because if you do, you can't manage it.
That's true. It is true. You know what, Alan? If you came to work at AT&T as a salesperson, they'd love you, because we want people to not be diverse at the network level. Like, you know, our whole company looks at that one and goes, Ed, pull that one out, because we'd like everybody to just use AT&T. I think that you're right. There are lots of different dimensions here. But it is hard, like if there's a particularly essential service that must withstand pretty concentrated attack, don't you feel a little bit more comfortable if it's replicated with some sort of a diverse, you know, backup? I guess if you do it right.
Not if you have to have six administrators.
That's
a fair
point. To
patch the six, because you can't find the people.
It's a fair point. It's a fair point. From somebody who knows. Nice to see Alan. Yes.
So what do you think the answer is to mobile computing, where the people who are coming out of college today want to be able to connect from anywhere, anytime, with their personal device?
Yeah, and it's not just kids in college, right? It's you and me too, right? I like using my phone all the time too. Like when you check into a hotel and you need to do your email and you have your laptop and your phone. To do it with your laptop, you have to flip the computer up and go, dun, 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 and the thing wakes up. And then you got to negotiate Wi-Fi. That might take a little bit of time, and you got about probably have to pay for it. Like a couple months ago, I checked in. Here in Washington, I had my name spelled wrong, and I was in a rush. And I go, I'll just leave it. The whole week for Wi-Fi, I'm typing my name in wrong to get Wi-Fi. So then once you get Wi-Fi, you have to nail up a VPN using your little RSA token, and then you're on the enterprise network. Then you have to, like, maybe there's a domain password, and you go, da-da-da-da-da, waiting for that. Then you click on a little Outlook button, and boom, there's your email. Probably took you about 4 or 5 minutes. Versus the BlackBerry going, boop, and you get it, and you go. Now, I know there's a lot of stuff behind the scenes. I mean, I run the VPN at AT&T, so I get that. But it's a dramatically different user experience, fundamentally different, and we got to come up with some sort of computing model. Now, the theme of what we're talking about, one of the major themes today, is cloud, right? So the question is, couldn't the service provider, if it understood the policy that your organization wanted to respect, why couldn't they just go ahead and respect it? And I've got a program at AT&T where we've been building out the infrastructure so that for an agency, for a business, for a consumer, if you go into a portal and you say, this is my policy, then as you go out across a 3G and eventually 4G network, that 4G network will keep you off Facebook if you're a mom and dad and don't want the kids on Facebook, or if you're a bank and you want people to be able to go directly to some cloud infrastructure and not to a bunch of, you know, inappropriate websites, we can do that too. We can block inbound telnets and FTPs that might be coming in across some mobile interface and so on and so forth. So I think the answer as we move forward is that as mobile access becomes more the norm than the exception for internet access, the carrier is going to have to play a pretty fundamental role in respecting policy and enforcing it. Here, and then we'll do in the back.
I think it's fair to say that all your points are essentially defensive. What is the potential for offensive operations against some of these people, the hackers, for
example? It's a tough one. Like a lot of people, when I show pictures of botnets to military staff and so on, we show them controllers and we show them, you know, bots, and we'll show that live attacks. Like if we were in our ops center, I'd bring up and I'd show you businesses being attacked right now, and somebody always says they can't take it anymore. Hand goes up, and they look at me, and they point at me, sometimes point finger in the chest and go, why don't you take them out? Like I love, take them out. And the first question is, what do you mean by that? Like going and bombarding them with something or actively going off and doing something. The problem in a botnet context is I'd be knocking out my mother's PC, right? I mean, that's where the bots are running around all of us. So that's a problem. Now, the idea of intrusion detection versus intrusion prevention is a good sort of example of active versus defensive. And IPSs presumably are supposed to detect a problem, hopefully reliably, and then go do something like putting an auto shun for that source IP. I'll bet you if I queried most of you, 9 out of 10 of you, if you have IPSs, you're running in non-active mode. Why? Because hackers can come lob a bunch of crap at your IPS and blind out whatever portions of the internet you'd like to blind out. I mean, it's a problem we have at AT&T where when we turn on our IPSs, we see cases that we can generate from the outside that affect our infrastructure. Now, I will tell you, I run active mode IPS, but it's not easy. And you really do have to do it in very controlled circumstances. So the idea of going after something, going after a source, requires that you know what you want to do and who you're doing it to. And I think those are two weaknesses in the in our ability to do computer security now. Question in the back.
That cloud-based services create a disincentive to collect information intelligently? And if so, how can we re-incentivize intelligent
collection? I don't think so. I think go ahead.
Because the pricing for companies, for example, may be based on functionality and not at all on quantity.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I have much comment on that. Just from a security perspective, I think there's a couple of considerations. There are organizations that do an unbelievably good job in protecting infrastructure, they build some fortress, they've got encryption, they've got good protection, they've got proactive security. You know, picking that up and moving it into a cloud to, you know, maybe some low-end provider would be a big mistake. Like, I think they'd probably see a net reduction in the, you know, threat mitigation. Might save a bunch of money, and there's that classic curve of save money, get lower security. So you do see that decision being made. But in a lot of cases, you see infrastructure that's poorly protected, where there's a lot of insider attacks, for example, that are completely ignored. And, you know, it's like I got 30,000 employees, 100,000 employees, 300,000 employees. They all have access to something, and you assume that they're all trustworthy, so you give them direct access. Putting something off in a cloud and making people actually authenticate and go through some degree of integrity check, maybe with their PC or whatever, before they access is not a bad idea. Like at AT&T, all the training courses that we take, they get DDoSed inadvertently the day before the last day for training has to be done. So Sunday night, you know, this is all training, like disability training and, you know, not taking bribes and all the stuff that corporations, you know, train their employees to do. And it's pretty funny because the usage goes like this, bup, 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 and here's the day, that last day up, you know, it shoots way up. You know, in some sense, has an impact on our enterprise network that day. So the idea now is we're going to push that all out into our internet cloud hosting and let people access it either through VPN directly to the cloud system or directly over the internet. We think in that case, I get a little better performance, probably a little better security. I'm taking infrastructure out of my enterprise and pushing it out where it's more ubiquitous. And for us, the courses are generic enough that we're thinking maybe we can genericize them just a little bit more and sell the training courses to other companies. Like all these business models pop up when you go ahead and push things off into the cloud. So we're pretty excited about that. Maybe we take one more and then we'll do the panel. Or zero more. Oh, one more. We'll do one more.
If you'd comment on trusted internet connection with respect to your tenants?
Yeah. Trusted internet connection, the first piece of it was that the internet connections that we have across government are too complicated and there's a lot of problems. And man, we said go team, that's absolutely true. You know, having built a lot of these, we see configuration A for this agency, configuration B for this one, all driven by RFPs, right? So the RFP dictates what's in there, and we see varying levels of intensity around security. Like sometimes there might be a CIO that's under intense pressure to get something fielded, and that might be done to the, you know, where some security requirements would be pushed aside in a sense, in the interest of getting something pushed out. So we agreed totally that looking at the gateway infrastructure into and out of the civilian agencies was a very good idea, totally there. The idea of making them into a fewer number, The thing I like about it is that it simplifies. So complexity equals bad. We've known that for 25 years. So simplifying is good. The problem is, are you creating DDoS bottlenecks in doing so? Like instead of having the CDN-like situation where I've got so many endpoints, you can't affect continuity of government simply because there's no tractable way to hit all of government. If you collapse it into a few number of places, then obviously the risk of causing continuity of government problems rises. Well, the answer to that is defense in depth. You've got to push the protection out into the cloud and the carrier, or you know, it could be pseudo-carriers, like in the TIC concept and in MTIPS, you have different gradations of gateway. So it could be, you know, these aggregated gateways could be a defense in depth against the back-end gateways. Then the carrier is a defense in depth for the entry points to government. There's some nice ways to do it. So you got to balance the defense in depth with commonality. As Alan said, right now, if you look at most of the gateways, you've got umpteen different configurations run in umpteen different ways. I like the idea of a common approach where everybody is kind of comfortable with kind of a set of best practices. So a lot that's good about it, but we've got to be careful. It has to be done right. And, you know, the role that the carrier plays, obviously, is that it's got to be able to stop and throttle volume attacks before they hit those MTIPS gateways. That could be catastrophic if that's not done properly. Excellent question. I'm going to step down now. We've got some really wonderful speakers here. Looking forward to hearing them as well. And I'll join you in the audience and watch. But thank you very much.
Well, great. Thank you. Now I'd like to turn to the panel, which is really a pretty impressive panel, if I say so myself. Let me introduce them, and then what we'll do is we'll just go down the line, have them each speak, and then take some questions. I'll introduce them in the order they appear in your handout, if you got one. We ran out, I understand. Marjorie Blumenthal, most of us know these people, right? So they're famous. Marjorie Blumenthal, now at Georgetown, we all know her as the Executive Director for the National Academy's Computer Science and Telecommunications Board. Are you the founding director? Yeah, so pretty cool. Also on the Pew Internet Advisory Board, one of the true gurus in this field, although we fight all the time. So, no, but she is a leader in this. Mark Foreman, also a leader. First U.S. Administrator for e-government and information technology. I was telling Mark before the thing that at the second event I ever had at CSIS, he was the speaker. So I'm glad he could come back. He was the federal government's first chief information officer, and now, of course, he's the practice leader for the Federal Information Technology Advisory at KPMG. So, Mark, welcome back. Paul Kurtz, another person I've known since the dawn of time. Paul, your list is too long here, Paul. Worked at the White House, the Homeland Security Council. It's not on your bio here, but you were the Clinton administration transition team leader for cybersecurity. Obama. Freudian slip, right? Yeah. And is now over at Good Harbor and still exceptionally active. Finally, Steve Lipner, who, as you heard in the opening remarks, is one of the true pioneers in this field. He's the director of security engineering at Microsoft. He's got over 30 years' experience. He's one of the people, along with Marjorie, that we call when we have really hard questions. So I'm really grateful that they could come here. Paul, why don't we start with you and then just go down the row? Okay.
Thank you, Jim. And Ed, thanks for your comments. In Washington, it's rare that you can have a thought-provoking and entertaining discussion at the same time, and I thought yours was just that. So with that as a starter, don't expect mine to be thought-provoking and entertaining. I'm going to try to boil this down and make it as simple as I can. I think there are six evaluative criteria or items folks need to think about when they evaluate cloud computing in the context of security. And the term that is not really an English word is securability. What is the securability of the cloud? And so let me put out six things to keep in mind. One is in the cloud versus, if you will, we have two models, client-server paradigm, cloud paradigm. Obviously, there's a lot of discussion over the models. NIST has its guidance. There are enormous business interests that are in play here, and we'll just put that right out in the middle of the room because that's a huge issue. But when we look at it, I think there are six areas. The ability to perform software upgrades and to patch where you have problems. Number two, access control. What is the ability to implement access control? Number three, confidentiality and data leakage. What is your ability to ensure that your data maintain is secure and is not leaking to others that it shouldn't go to? Fourth item, auditing and compliance. What is your ability to actually understand what's happening on your system and your ability to comply with regulatory mandates that are out there in order to demonstrate the security of your systems? Number five, availability and disaster recovery. What is your ability to maintain that data online at the user's fingertips so they can do their job each and every day? And if you have a really bad day, how do you recover? Can you recover quickly? And number six is the applicability of security standards. In other words, can you apply 27001 in the context of the cloud? A well-known security standard, or SysTrust, whatever it may be, what is the ability to apply standards? So if you look at the cloud, I think there's a reasonable argument that can be made that it is securable. And in some cases, you might argue that it provides a much contrary to what you might think, it provides a smaller attack plane for the adversary. In that if you have an exceptionally complicated enterprise environment where you have multiple computers, multiple servers, multiple platforms with applications, it becomes exceptionally difficult for an IT administrator to keep that up to speed, to keep it patched. It becomes exceptionally difficult to understand where all your computing power is and where data may be stored or the ability to copy data off systems. You can argue that at the end of the day, the cloud may be more secure than the client-server paradigm. However, there are clearly issues that are out there that we have to balance, and that is our desire to maintain control over information, to have it within four walls. And there are certainly, arguably, certain applications, certain functionality that government may have or large enterprise may have that they would far prefer to keep it within four walls. My punchline here to think about at the end, because this is not only cloud computing, but it's also mobility. We have two major, if you will, gravitational forces pulling at us in the computing environment today. One is the inverse pull up into the cloud for computing, and at the same time, mobility at the individual user level. These two pieces go hand in hand, because what's going to really enable mobility, the ability to have lots of functionality in your hand at any one time, no matter where you are on Earth, is the cloud. So it makes a lot of sense to me to think carefully about how we make that cloud securable in the end. So what are the standards we used? My final point, there is an organization called the Cloud Security Alliance, CSA, stood up in April. It's a grassroots organization. They came out, unlike a lot of other organizations. When they rolled out, they rolled out a document, which is contrary to the way a lot of organizations work. They roll out the organization, and then months later, a document follows. They came out with a document in April, and in the coming week or so, they will come out with version 2 of their document, which basically is an improvement on the first document. In a sense, it gets into the discussion of kind of the who, what, when, where, and why to go to the cloud and some of the major questions people ought to keep in mind. I'm not arguing here for wholesale rush to cloud computing, because there are some serious questions that any enterprise needs to contemplate. But at the same time, it is very worthy of thinking of, and I think security can be introduced as almost a red herring to stumble, cause enterprises to stumble from actually migrating into the cloud. I think there's a little more thorough discussion that could be had on securability and some challenging discussion, but ultimately that may be the better place to be in the long run.
Well, thank you, Jim, also for me for inviting me here, because I was looking for a reason to force myself to pull together some thoughts on the cloud, and you gave it to me. You mentioned the early history with Unix, and right before I went to the academy, I had the dubious benefit of a front row seat for the demise of commercial time sharing, because I had been with a now defunct unit of General Electric, GE Information Services, and was trying to help them work through the challenge of taking what some might look at as cloud precursors, what we would now call data centers in multiple parts of the world and a multinational networking construct, and evolve them to more contemporary services. Of course, nobody ever talked about the Internet in that environment. But what I do remember is that the engineers in the firm were very proud of the fact that they could offer their customers security. At the time, I don't know that I could have evaluated that claim, but they were very, very confident of it. And hearing today's news about the sale of NBC, I think General Electric has totally walked away from communications. That's probably a good thing. So we've gone from 10 points to 6 points. I had three. Yes, three areas in which I clustered my thoughts. And I did take this assignment as one of accentuating the negative. That is, there are lots of things that one can hear at other meetings, other discussions about the positive aspects of the cloud, but we are focusing on security and thinking otherwise. So one of the concerns I have is with trust, nature of trust, trustworthiness. The second one would be looking at the cloud as a platform for malice. And the third picks up on Ed's comments about best practices with respect to data, because I think we need to rethink certain aspects of how we deal with data. So as Paul and others have alluded to, I think there's a kind of seductive proliferation in ways and reasons to use the cloud. Mobility, obviously, is a driver for that. So are other things. And from an individual's point of view, whether it's using social networking, using Gmail, there are a number of personal reasons to want to use the cloud, but I suspect that most individuals don't understand their true exposure to the extent their personal data are at issue to the cloud because of the trends for different kinds of organizations that they do business with to also use the cloud. And having some idea of what that big picture is, I think, might be useful, at least for analytical perspectives. Meanwhile, we're watching the evolution of what some have called the cloud ecosystem. There are the private kinds of clouds that Ed referred to in AT&T. There are the public ones. There are hybrids. And a number of people, in talking about other kinds of standards and the security ones that Paul referred to, are thinking about different approaches to having standards to allow clouds to interconnect. So the world of the inner cloud is one that we need to look forward to, and again, to understand what does it mean to have trust in this very diffuse environment. Ultimately, when we talk about trust, we're thinking about risk sharing, and you can find some discussions of the taxonomy of different kinds of clouds and the boundary of the user versus the provider for where risk is allocated shifts in those contexts. But it's not always clear that people understand what all of the risks are. You know, every so often there's the cautionary tale. I think in the last few months there was the T-Mobile Sidekick loss of people's personal data. It was found and recovered, but you know, incidents like that at least give people pause. I think Ed is right that the privacy community doesn't entirely have its story down, but I think that's different from saying that there aren't concerns about privacy. And just to clarify for those who aren't in certain rooms, that's one of the issues that Jim and I fight about. But I think this is an area where we need to do some better study, and I think that this whole question of trust is one where we're obviously going to be looking at a combination of legal mechanisms and technical mechanisms, that the technology may not be sufficient. And my guess is that part of the legal work that may be done is to encourage better disclosure about what it is you're really getting with a service and what the protections being offered by the provider really are, and so on. But if in the limit, in this inter-cloud world, in this much more system-intensive world, you know, we end up looking like Estonia, then you know, we have to have some way to think about how we're going to protect ourselves and have the availability that the previous two speakers talked about. So if I think about the cloud as a possible new platform of malice, and I think this is an area that my guess is a number of people can think about, the first level of concern is with the provider. And obviously we have a lot of history with outsourcing and a lot of ways to protect various customers should there be a provider that goes rogue. But we have the less well understood set of circumstances that come from concentration of market. A lot of people like to shoot at Google. That is not going to be my intention. But there are a lot of questions that people have about what happens when, for certain applications, you have maybe one provider. Again, Ed said he wants everybody to use AT&T for the network. I mean, there is a certain amount of concentration. We don't necessarily know what that means, but we don't necessarily have diversity in the business space. And there's a colleague of mine who is wondering about whether privacy or some other implications of constantly scanning your content. And he tells the story about how, based on a search that he got and responding to an advertisement that was put up, he got messages addressed to John Doe terrorist. I mean, you can tell what he was looking up, but it is interesting. You wonder what that firm was thinking as they actually started to look at the correspondence they set out in an automated way. But my real concern about the cloud as a possible platform for malice is really about users. And so, you know, if we are the users and we want to hide, you know, maybe the cloud is a kind of cutout mechanism that we can use. And it's only speculation, but one does wonder, are we going to see the Russian business network of clouds if we've seen them in the ISP environment? So some monitoring, again, of this population of cloud providers may be worth doing. There are also questions about havens. At a meeting that Suzanne was responsible for over the summer, Stu Baker talked about this notion of the cloud fleeing the subpoena, which was a wonderful image. Well, if clouds are designed for reliability and maintenance reasons to allow virtual machines to be migrated, to allow hypervisors to be migrated, then maybe it isn't so unreasonable to think about the cloud fleeing the whatever. And, you know, what do we think about that? And I don't know that there is an answer, but it's just worthy of some thought. But there are other kinds of insider threats, and some of you may have seen the work that Evan Tromer and some others have done, I think originally out of UC San Diego. There's now some of this activity at MIT, where some people with background in cryptography have started talking about cloud cartography and ways in which smart use of technology and probing can help one to make the cloud less cloudy, to help people to map whose stuff is where within the cloud, so that you could then place yourself closer to that and then either monitor things. There are side channel issues that people are beginning to study. So although that kind of research suggests the kind of opportunity, kind of problem that it may be that other researchers will find counter mechanisms for, the basic principle that the cloud is less cloudy than we might think, I think, is worth noting. And also this concept of cartography and finding where exactly which server your target of interest is located on reminds us of a point that Jack Goldsmith made a decade ago and against cyber anarchy, that ultimately there is a physical system. We can talk about the cloud, we can talk about things being out there, but somewhere there is something physical and somebody may be able to find it. So lots of food for thought. So that brings me to the third point on data. I think ultimately, if I go back to, again, a comment that Ed made about, there was a quick reference to the fortress in the cloud. My question would be, should the fortress be in the cloud or out of the cloud? And some of what Paul was talking about got at this notion of what goes where. So I think as people have different experiences with the cloud and worry about those things that they want to keep within the four walls was, I think, something that you said, that maybe we need to be more conscious of what it is that's core to us in terms of data and what isn't. You know, there is a school of thought, for example, that says that anything in the cloud is public. And if that is your view, then you want to think about what you're going to put in the cloud, what you're going to put elsewhere. There clearly are reasons to think that the cloud may be more flexible than other mechanisms, but even if it is securable, the question is whether it's secure enough. But we can think about data in transit because we have uploading and downloading, and then we have migration inside the cloud in various ways. We can think about durability of data. The data, in fact, may be more available in the cloud than in some alternatives, but it also may be more available over time than we might like. I think a lot of people are uncertain about whether deletions really happen, because sometimes it's good to forget. And how do we actually manage to control that? Now, there are people who have a counter to that, and there is work being done on self-destructing data. So, again, you could have a problem, and then you have a counter mechanism. And it may be that data should be an appropriate focus for future work. Encryption, obviously, is an answer that some people are working on, and you will find plenty of people who will point out that encryption often isn't done right and is otherwise defeated or worked around. The notion of deception that was made by Ed earlier relates to some work that people are doing in terms of decoys with respect to data. And so if you add noise to your data, then it is harder to find the stuff that really matters. But in any event, as I was saying, the idea of thinking about data, being more conscious about what you put in the cloud, and thinking about data-focused ways of protecting what you really care about, may be one path forward. Ed actually used one of the cliches that I was thinking about, which is the one about putting all your eggs in a basket and watching that basket. And so in preparing remarks for today, I guess the question that came to my mind was, can we actually watch that basket? Can we actually watch that basket well enough? And if we can't, then you have to go back to the previous cliche, which is, you know, don't put all your eggs in one basket, and that may be really the way to go forward. Thanks.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. So I feel like I guess I need to turn that on. I feel like I got a bit of an introduction by Ed, but maybe that was an introduction to some past iteration of Steve Lipner. My day job is the secure development practices at Microsoft, where we've beginning in 2002 put a lot of effort into trying to reduce the vulnerability rates in the software we build, and happy to answer questions about that. Maybe happier to answer questions about that than about inside the Beltway policy issues. We did release a paper about security, including things like secure development in for cloud computing a couple weeks ago, and that's available for download if people are interested. And I was involved in the development of that, so I think that may be one of the reasons why I'm here. I wrote down some very brief notes that I thought might be relevant to what I assume is an audience that's not so interested in address space randomization and the effectiveness of fuzz testers. There's a paper out of ENISA, the European Network and Information Security Agency, part of the EU system. I'm not sure what the governmental wiring is, but they do studies and strategies and positions for the European Union on matters of computer and internet security, and they've published a framework for security in cloud computing that I think is worth looking at. It talks about the different flavors of cloud entities, software as a service, platform as a service, infrastructure as a service, and some of the security considerations associated with each of those, and some of the risk considerations and countermeasures that are relevant. And I think that's a good framework for people to look at, and I just encourage them to see that. Thinking about cloud from my own perspective, you know, it's obvious that cloud is an important new technology. I mean, you do see a lot of coverage about cloud trends, cloud developments, new cloud offerings, and so on. It's amusing because Alan Paller and I were talking before the session started about new and old and GE time sharing, and then you know I sit down in the chair here and listen to Marjorie, and I find that she's another person who remembers that iteration of the cloud. So there's some similarities from some things long ago, and some lessons that we should have learned if we'd paid attention to them, and maybe they carry forward. Although clearly there are a lot of new things yet. You know, as Marjorie said, nobody was talking about the internet as the commercial distributed computing or commercial timesharing offering. Back in the 70s and 80s when we had GE time sharing. So there are certainly a lot of things to learn and a lot of considerations to sort out. One of the things I think that's I'm sort of get down to three important considerations, and I think Paul gave a good cut at another way of looking at security for the cloud, but just some considerations that I thought were important. Number one, if you're relying on the cloud, then secure development is still important. Okay, and that potentially breaks down into two different areas. Number one, if you're relying on the cloud provider has to do secure development. And number two, if you're building applications to host in the cloud, you likely also have to do secure development. And those two things probably have to complement. So that's a matter, you know, sort of geekiness or technology, where you have to address both sides of those things. They have to work right individually, and you have to understand where the seams or the interfaces are. The second aspect, and I think that Paul referred to it as well, concerns secure configuration or secure operation or secure deployed architecture of the IT infrastructure that you're relying on. Paul referred to the ISO 27000 standards, which are a good framework for thinking about all the things that you have to pay attention to in building a secure IT system. I have to have trust in my operations. I have to have some auditing capability, and I have to do something with the audit trail. I have to have physical security over my machine rooms if there's sensitive data in plain text in the machine rooms, or even if I'm worried about somebody stealing the machines. So a lot of things that that have been developed in a little earlier era and still apply. And again, if I'm taking an application and hosting it in the cloud, then A, I'm relying on that cloud provider to do his part of the secure architecture and secure deployment and secure operations and secure patching, and B, I may have to do that myself as well. Okay, if I'm using what Anissa calls infrastructure as a service and hosting on raw machines, then somebody's got to operate and maintain and manage and back up and patch those virtual operating systems and those virtual machines, and that may be me, or that may be the cloud provider, or that may be some combination of us. But those are considerations that arise. So in some ways, a lot of the lessons of history still apply, and they get a little more complicated in the cloud. That brings me to the last point I wanted to raise, which is that, and I think I've been sort of implicit about this, you're dependent on, I'm using you, assuming that you're thinking about hosting the cloud. If you're thinking about hosting in the cloud, you've got to understand exactly what you're getting, at an operational, at a policy, at a technical, technical and software level. What is the cloud provider doing for you? What security assurances is he providing? What protections? Physical security, personnel security, as well as IT and operational security. What protections do you have to take to complement those? How do they integrate together to make sure that the potential threats are covered? A little bit of a plug. We've been working for a long time, 10 years, with a discipline we call threat modeling that we apply primarily in the design of software to understand where the attack points are and where we have to mitigate attacks. But it's an approach that we've also looked at for infrastructure and other things. And I think you need to do something like that just to make sure that you've sort of covered all the bases and things haven't fallen through the cracks. So that's a sort of a perspective on cloud computing that I think might be relevant, might be worth looking at, and at least food for some discussion.
Great, thank you, Mark. You got the bat cleanup.
All right. Well, I'll maybe raise it to a higher non-technical, business-oriented level. I want to quickly go through four points, and I guess then we'll open for discussion. I think it's really important to understand the driving technology trends that are really business or operational trends here. The thing that makes cloud computing different from the time-sharing days when I started doing econometric modeling and things like that is really this technology trend that's bifurcated over the last 5 years or so. When we were doing computers, even in the client-server era, we were automating business processes. Along around the late 90s or mid-90s, that shifted largely because of the Internet, but I'd probably say also because of Microsoft's focus on the user. And many of you remember 10 years ago, the fight was often between that easy-to-use Microsoft or Netscape interface and the green screens and the blue screens of the old mainframe era. But if you looked at the processes, they were being automated in silos, and a lot of the effort was still get the people out of the process. The value proposition was cost savings through high-quality, repeatable processes. Well, now we're on two tech trends. One, which is continuing and will continue and probably drive the cloud, is still around automation. But that automation is now moving into mega enterprise services. If you look at apps.gov or you look at where a lot of the applications that are moving the cloud are going, it's not because they're on the cloud. It's because they're commoditized. So Nicholas Carr's forecast about the commoditization of IT is driving one tech trend around highly automatable business processes. The other major trend is what we'd call the knowledge process or knowledge processing trend, driven by things like problem solving, cloud business intelligence, the use of crowdsourcing, collaborative problem solving mechanisms, where the emphasis is on pulling users into the internet and pulling them online for the purpose of sharing. And that's just as well moving to the cloud because of the heavy-duty cost of trying to maintain all your own data, trying to solve problems within your silos. So we have two major trends, and if you look at how it relates to the cloud, you look at enterprise services, you look at aggregation, economies of scale, you look at the cost structure, whether you're talking about infrastructure as a service, platform as a service, or software as a service. You cannot compete with the cost structure that's 1/10th or 1/100th of the cost of applications and data that are or are becoming available over the cloud. So the second point I'd like to make is that you have to look at the security issue in three domains. One is the data itself. And I'm going to challenge the notion that we should be concerned about securing the data, because I think largely what we're talking about here, at least in one of the major trends, you cannot accelerate problem solving, you cannot do a better job at solving problems with everybody maintaining their own version of the data. We have, in the government and across industry, major issues with deconflicting redundant data sources. So we're securing a bunch of redundant data, and we're into a totally different risk paradigm than if we're sharing and we're using market forces to secure the data. I'd liken this to the newspaper industry and media. So if you look, for example, at what I think is one of the most disruptive forces, Google Earth, compare that to what you can get on the cloud for certain sets of data, to even things like recovery.gov and the question of, is this house located next to me that's getting a grant really a construction site? You know, if I look in the intelligence community, can I get the same or most of the data cheaper off of Google Earth? Do I trust it anymore? And you look at a totally different assurance marketplace-based approach for that data. On applications, I think you're looking at an opportunity where, again, you've got commoditized apps, market forces that are driving you to very high-quality applications at investment models that you can't match company by company. When you look at the network area, then I look at companies like AT&T and others and assume that we're going to evolve to new sets of service level requirements and forcing them to secure the data in transit. And that's the area that I worry most about. I think that the data becomes democratized, as Vivek Kundra has said. Largely, you get data sources that are better. You get media models that qualify or assure the data better in different ways than IT security. On apps, you get commoditization. But I think that raises some questions, and my third point would be that emerging risk paradigm that we know we've always had to use in making IT security determinations. And so a few questions. Will the marketplace determine new sets of service level requirements? And will that be the basis for providing assurance across those three domains of data, applications, and network? Will cloud security become an open source almost viral aspect, like the scenario that we see with the cloud service, cloud security alliance. I think it's if you look at what's going on in Silicon Valley, if you look at what's going on in the world, the models are such that it's very low cost of entry, and there's a business to be made around security, so you could expect to see that viral approach. And the third question in risk, will data become democratized? In other words, once the data goes into the cloud, once you take a look at some of these cloud business intelligence models and you figure out you can get a lot better data, a lot cheaper from the cloud, marrying your data with what's in the cloud, can you ever put that genie back in the bottle? Would you ever go back to securing it, the data, in the way that you had before? And I'll come back to that in a minute. So my fourth point is, I think the cloud security model has some different paradigms, building a lot on what the group talked about. But I think the first question is, what's the homogeneous environment? If you're going to have security, you've somehow got to figure out what that environment looks like and what's homogeneous about it and what's heterogeneous about it. The location of the data and how you manage that, even though it's going into the cloud physically, it's going to reside somewhere, and that has to be secure. The auditing and monitoring we talked about, boundary protection, we talked about the access paths. So even though we'd like to think of the cloud as this amorphous thing, Microsoft doesn't have amorphous cloud data centers. They've got containerized data centers, if you will, sitting in the Chicago area, others around where you can get low-cost power. These paths are known, and those have to be managed. And then the final is service provisioning and what those service level requirements would look like. So with those four points, I'll leave you with one question. Given the market force dynamics and the cost structure here, and given people's unwillingness to move data into the cloud that would be unsecured, are we focused on the right thing? Might there be two models? And ought we maybe more focus, because I know the threats well, on the data that does not move to the cloud, because those are going to be where the jewels are.
That was a tremendous panel. I'm really impressed. I don't know if people have questions. I mean, I can jumpstart things. Let me start by, I'm going to start with a question then. What about identity? And when we talk about identity in the cloud, you know, what do we mean? How is it more important than what we thought about before? We haven't done a very good job at authentication of identity in the current environment. Does it get easier, harder, different as we move to this new environment? Everyone speak at once.
I'll take a jump in. I actually think it becomes a lot easier. Again, I'd look at models like Google Earth and the ability to do different identity management paradigms based on use and behavior, location, et cetera, especially in the mobile environment, becomes much more simple to factor. Now, mathematically, you can have a whole different set of models and so forth that will probably have to be built. I think a lot of them are being built now. So it's a bit of a different paradigm, but I think it becomes easier.
I think it becomes important because you know you're at a distance from your data, and actually I think you know some of the thoughts in the commission report about identity and authentication and strong authentication are good pointers to the way that we really need to move as a society, so that we get away from this notion of reusable passwords, which are always spelled password, with the backup or recovery mechanism being your mother's maiden name. I mean, good to get away from that. I think probably more important to get away from that in the cloud than certainly on a system in a confined area.
I would just say one of the questions that came to mind in response to your question was whether there is a viable way for individuals or entities to manage multiple identities in the cloud better than they may be able to do in other computing environments. And that's just
a question.
Real quick, I think that the cloud enables, one, the ability of people who simply want to surf, to use the old word, so to speak, Washington Post, New York Times, whatever it is, to understand and see what's out there, it's there, and they can do anonymously if they like. I also think the cloud, at least certain applications of software as a service and others, allow for multi-factor authentication. The hitch is if we have massive migration into the cloud and a great number of computing capabilities are up in the cloud, how are we going to manage all these credentials in the cloud? And that needs more study, but I really believe it's solvable. I mean, we have a problem as it is today with what everybody's doing. If you have fewer platforms, fewer computing platforms in the sky, that should argue that you would need fewer credentials at the end of the day. But it does need study.
Okay. I had some friends from the government visiting yesterday, and they remarked that they both had been issued smart cards for their can't remember the HSPD. HSPD 12 credential, but none of their organizations had had smart card reading infrastructure to authenticate them to their systems with it. So we know how to do this. Doing it at scale is still not easy.
I think there is another industry that will be spawned in this process. If you look at the credit card industry, they are moving towards a smart card infrastructure.
They're
going that way, and my bet there's going to be a business overlay on this that will play into the Internet as well.
That will help.
John?
Yeah, Margie, first I want to preface my question by saying my first program experience was on a GE625, and I always got to hold back these error statements, and I knew it must have been the computer. So it
must
the program.
Have.
But along with the identity management, touched a little bit on data integrity. Mark mentioned the issue of resolving various data sets when you put your data in more than one location and you update one file but not the other, and then try to figure which is the right file. What about the whole data integrity issue in the cloud? If you have a democratic database, how do you maintain the integrity of the data in any
serious way? And that's I think that's probably one of the other great challenges, which we didn't really touch on in the panel discussion.
I would, and I can tell Paul wants to say something. I would, A, echo the question as a good question. B, observe that a number of people have noticed that in some cloud context you have what is eventual consistency instead of strict consistency of data, and that isn't always a good thing. Plus this notion...
Well, the data dies off somewhere along the way.
Right.
The data got away.
Right. So I think that is a huge area, which is not to take away from Mark's general point, which is that it can be very counterproductive to have these separate and conflicting data stores.
I go back to the initial question that Jim asked on the issue of authentication. I think when it comes to integrity, two issues are important. Authentication, how we authenticate who's coming in and out, including those who are hosting the capability. And the second issue is auditing. How do we actually audit what's happening in the cloud? And I think that holds some trickiness to it. If you are a large-scale provider and you have a wide variety of players altering the data, through positive means of authentication, how do you as a provider ensure that you can audit appropriately, that you don't have efforts underway to manipulate data or to corrupt data? But I think the two go hand in hand. If you pair the two together, auditing and authentication, we can get there. But the same problem exists in the client-server paradigm as well. It's just, once again, I argue fewer platforms, easier to handle.
We virtualized it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually think that we're going to see a dual source model. You know, already we have the emergence of these bring your data and compare it with ours models. In the past, I think a lot of institutions, companies collected data. You know, even today you have infomediaries that resell government data. So let's assume that data.gov moves forward and there's going to be an authoritative source for maybe half the data set that you'll want to use if you're doing business strategy or your annual plan, your forecasting or whatever. The question is, I think, will you as an entity have to maintain your data within your business intelligence or your data warehouse tool set yourself? Or will you have to just assure the part where you're doing the transactions and bring that into a different environment where somebody else assures data that's widely used? That seems to be the emerging model. You've got some that you're going to do on yourself, and you're going to get that marrying up with some data that's going to come from a provider who is also going to assure that data. That'll be driven by market forces.
We had one in the back. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, so cloud computing has really taken off this year, at least in our knowledge of it. And so the panel's already talked about the three broad classes of service you get from the cloud and service agreements around that. Infrastructure as a service, platform as a service, software as a service. But there hasn't been any discussion on what's already evolved on types of cloud. So some government agencies are running private clouds. Some companies are running private clouds. There's sort of the public cloud, get it from Amazon.com or other providers. There are some community clouds coming forward where somebody does it on behalf of several entities, and possible hybrids in between where you might get infrastructure from one model and software from another. So I'll ask that as a general question.
I like the most prevalent model, which is rename what I'm doing as cloud.
Nothing to add.
I would just say the remark I'd made about the emerging ecosystem is that, yes, I think there is evidence that there are all of those models and that there will be various forms of interconnection, and that this adds to the complexity that we're going to have to deal with.
We have time for, I think, a couple more, but I saw Ellen in the middle there, and then we've got one over here. Were you going to get a microphone?
I just have a assume cloud is basically a server or a container, someone said, that holds data. But someone must own that. And it seems to me these are generally carriers right now. This is a legal regime question. Who owns data in the cloud? If I put something up, I mean, I can understand there are times when you'd want to put data up and have it really widely accessible and share it. But maybe we'll get to a day when, you know, we want to put data up just so we can have it wherever we've traveled, but it's really what we consider to be personal and private. Do I really own it, or does the provider or carrier who's doing the service own it?
You're the lawyer.
They're going to be stumped because I thought about that question.
I'm not,
it's a hard one.
One, I'm not a lawyer.
I knew that, Paul.
I thought you said that. Ellen, I think they're if I'm reading from the Cloud Security Alliance paper here. They have essential characteristics of cloud computing. On-demand service. It's there. It's accessible via the Internet. Two, broad network access. Three, resource pooling. So in other words, you talked about just the data. It's not just the data. It's the applications as well. A key distinction. Rapid elasticity means it's readily expandable. Adding more users, adding more capability, it can be done very quickly. And it's more easy to measure service. That's what CSA has put forward. But I would think Microsoft and
I guess the bottom line is then there are different vectors through which the government with a subpoena could get the data if they wanted it.
So I sort of ducked back when you talked about ownership because I'm not an attorney, and you know I certainly would like to avoid playing one even on TV, but there are you know, I did raise the point about the property, the user understanding the properties of the cloud that are being used before deciding to host data in the cloud. And those are some considerations. You know, what protections does it have? You know, where? Who else can get at it? You know, what does the cloud provider promise you that he or she will do or not do? And those are all considerations. Now, I think Mark was talking a lot about sort of, you know, sharing and broad availability and integration of public kinds of data. For public kinds of data, you know, there are different matters. You've got to have integrity and integration that work. But for private data, you know, that's where, you know, all the different levels of security and protections come into play.
And where the legal ownership issues haven't yet been fully resolved.
I don't know that they have.
Thank you.
Ed, did you want to jump in here? Because speaker.
I have a quick question maybe for Steve and for the whole team. The Trusted Computing Initiative at Microsoft in the early 2000s obviously had some impact on Microsoft software development. As we move to cloud, I would think it becomes even more important that we get things correct. And I'm wondering if specifically TCI and more generally just the lessons of software engineering in the last few years, are there lessons that we can apply to maybe try and get the cloud infrastructure correct? Because if you get it wrong, it's more of a problem than we have now. So I wonder if there's some lessons learned there.
So from my perspective, I mean, we've actually been so TCI. I mean, I assume you're referring to Trustworthy Computing, the initiative we kicked off in 2002, and that's, you know, led us to change a variety of things, you know, over almost, I guess it's almost 8 years now, and, you know, including, you know, I referred to threat modeling, and, you know, applications get threat modeled before they get built, before they get deployed, pretty much universally. I mean, anything that goes on the internet, certainly, and a variety of kinds of automation and so on. You know, one of the things, you know, just to a point you made, one of the things that we've mandated is, you know, really geeky, something called address space randomization, which gets you diversity of the sort you were alluding to while preserving a common manageable platform, basically the same system of the sort that Alan was talking about. So a lot of things that we've learned and transformed over the years, integration of online services into our secure development practices, probably beginning about three and a half years ago, and continue, but, you know, but it's a learning process. I mean, you know, you referred to the Orange Book, so I'll sort of close with a reference to that. You know, in 1983. Thought we were going to build a secure system, prove it was secure, you know, put it on a disk, and I'll go find another job because that would be done. Nature hasn't been kind to that theory, and the reality is that new kinds of threats emerge, new kinds of attacks emerge, and we have to update our practices to address those attacks universally in development, and meanwhile we have to build our systems to be as resilient as we can make them in the presence of new kinds of attacks that are inevitably going to emerge. And that's just sort of the reality of the development world. But we think, you know, we've certainly made huge changes in the way we do development over the last 8 years, and it has paid off for us.
Let me play off Steve's remarks, and I think their efforts as well as efforts of others are coming together and more collectively looking at the issues of software assurance and software development. And the advertisement here is for SafeCode, the software assurance form for excellence in code, which is seven companies have come together to share practices in software development. in order to do it more securely and with greater assurance. And so Microsoft, naturally, with its early efforts, Symantec, Adobe, EMC, SAP, Nokia, and Juniper have all come together to work on a common set of practices. And now we're getting actually into the issue of supply chain integrity issues, which is a related field. So there are some practices out there that you know people can turn to, and all the work of Safecode is up and online that people can look at, and it's, I think, 90,000 downloads of our first document so far.
Okay, final two questions. We've got one here and one there. So
from a SaaS perspective, thank you. From a SaaS perspective, I was looking at Salesforce.com. They seem to have a pretty solid model, or a lot of tools and a toolkit for security, integration with your systems, that kind of thing. But also I just looked at YouSendIt, right? Because someone was like, well, how do I get it? Someone's sending me attachment into my company, and it keeps getting blocked. Looked at their little thing, looked pretty impressive. But from a SaaS perspective, what do you guys think are some top-notch, these guys are really doing it right. And the other thing I wanted to mention is, it doesn't seem like anybody's talking too much about bandwidth, but as soon as you get into the cloud, bandwidth is a huge issue. I mean, we just got Comcast 50 megabit, 10 megabit, and it sort of seems pretty good. But, it just really sends it through the stratosphere, pushing everything out to the cloud.
I don't have an answer on a service, but just on that last issue, which is something that I and a person who just left the room hope to be looking at, I think there are really big questions about bandwidth, especially as more and more people are using imagery in that bandwidth in one form or another. So there are questions about whether there is local processing on your device, for example, that does compression or other ways to alleviate the demand for bandwidth. But again, there's a complex of issues, and I think you're right on to flag that as a concern. Although historically, at least in the internet, we know that every time people warn about that, they were proven wrong. But we have to look at each problem anew.
Anyone else? No? Final question then.
Individuals or organizations that commit their data to the cloud presume that their ownership extends wherever the data may be resident within the cloud, however one defines it. I'm interested in any comments that you have on how legal organizations are to determine where their jurisdiction extends within the cloud, and their ability to extend their legal authority across data in the cloud or its functioning.
The only thing I'll say, Jake, on that is that I know the Cloud Security Alliance, one of the elements, they have 13 domains, and one of the domains is focused on the legal implications of the cloud and when you have a subpoena and you have to search
building. Production.
Recovery. Oh, yeah. I'm blowing it. But
discovery.
Yeah, discovery. Thank you. Legal issues in discovery, that there are some questions and some guidance that is being developed in that place that potential buyers should ask themselves and ask of the vendor as to how that works in that context. One of the things that's fairly powerful about the Cloud Security Alliance is it's not just vendors that are a part of it. It's users as well as the government to the degree that they can follow along activity, including entities like NIST. And I can't speak to whether or not the Department of Justice, I don't know, Betty, you're sitting there, but I don't know if Justice is sitting within CSA. I should know, but I don't.
Well, as I was listening to people talking just on that last note, it occurred to me that we are one thing that we haven't talked about, and we don't have time to, is that as we move into a cloud and mobile environment, I think it's going to change people's thinking about location and space. A couple of the speakers talked about what I would call geolocation, right? We're going to move into an environment perhaps where individuals will be mapped to their hardware in some way that we aren't used to. We're already starting to see that in some applications. So that last question was a good one, in that we are not this isn't the 90s again with the, you know, sovereignty doesn't work and all this stuff, but we're going to have to rethink how we apply the rules of space and location to this new environment. And that would be a really good topic, but we're out of time. So I think what I'd like to do is ask you to join me. And Ed, did you have any final words? Anyone on the panel? Final blessings, thoughts? No? Well, join me in thanking everyone for a very rich session.